and gentlemen. My name is Bill Hudson. I'm the chairman of the House Task Force on Telecommunications, appointed by Speaker Barnes during the last session to monitor and to try to protect the public's interest in the issue of restructuring telecommunications in the state of Alaska. This morning, August 27th, it's nice to be here in Anchorage. We have with us one of the members of our task force, Representative Mike Navarre from Kenai, Representative Harley Oldworth, who is the other member, there are three of us appointed, is not able to be here today because of illness. We had discussed with him, he intended to be here, but he's unable to do so, and it's my understanding that Sandy Provost is either here or going to be here to kind of listen in and to represent his interest. Also at the table, Representative Brian Porter, right over here to my left, and Representative Kay Brown, and former Lieutenant Governor, and one of my colleagues in the House when I first came into the House, Representative Red Boucher. And Red is going to be testifying today, and I've invited him to join us at the table. I'd also like to recognize in the audience, although there's many friends and people that I recognize out there, but somebody that I've worked with is the former commissioner of CNRA, Emil Noddy. And Emil, nice to have you here today, sir. And there'll be many others, of course, that are here to testify and some to listen in. I believe we may be joined by the Speaker of the House in time, sometime this morning here. But in order to get this going, we're going to go ahead and start now. The way I'd like to deal with this, as I've given everybody kind of an outline of the agenda, we're going to start out with Susan Knowles. And thank you for joining us this morning, Susan, who will be providing us a briefing on the joint board proposal. And what I'm going to do is I have a few questions after pouring over literally a foot of material that's been presented to my committee over the time, and I'll be asking various questions and asking in some cases for information and perhaps for some documentation. The interest of this committee or this task force is to try to make certain that we protect the consumer, the people of Alaska, including rural Alaska as well as urban Alaska. It's not a new subject. It's something that's been around as long as I've been involved in government. I can remember as a former commissioner of administration when we first created telecommunications, combined all of the telecommunications in the state of Alaska, the subject was there. So it's always been there. Alaska is unique. It's a different state. We have far-flung vast geography, small population centers, and different cost factors, I think, that probably exist anywhere else in the nation, perhaps not in the world. And so what we're going to try to do as we go through this is to make certain that we have a good, clear record of what the proposals are. As much as anything else, what I hope to achieve is to understand what's on the table from the various entities out there, from the joint board. I'd like to understand from the governor's office what the administration's position is on the various proposals. We're anxious to hear from AT&T and GCI and Alascom and others that will testify and have an interest in this, and ultimately from people representing themselves as well as Alaskan groups. So with that, I'd like to get started this morning. I'll ask you to give us your name and your position for the record, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Susan Knowles. I'm a commissioner on the Alaska Public Utilities Commission. However, I'm appearing before you today as a member of the, affectionately called the Alaska Joint Board, not as an APUC commissioner. Appearing with me today and sharing in these comments is a staff member of the APUC, Common Carrier Specialist Lori Kenyon. Under the Communications Act, the FCC establishes joint boards to deal with certain issues that cross federal and state boundaries. The joint boards are comprised of seven members. There are four state members and three federal members. And in the case of the Alaska Joint Board, the other state members come from Idaho, North Dakota, and Pennsylvania. Additionally, there is a staff established to assist the Joint Board in its duties made up of federal and state members. The job of the Joint Board is to make a recommendation to the full SEC. And in this instance, this Joint Board was established in 1985 based on a proceeding, or within a proceeding that began in 1983. I have personally served on the Joint Board since 1987. My predecessor was Martin Weatherly, whom some of you probably know. This morning, I thought about what I should say, given the fact that you are stepping into what is a 10-year proceeding, which has got an enormous amount of information that's been filed in it. Extremely technical in nature, a lot of it, and I'm sure you're aware by now, if you weren't from the get-go, that there's some level of contentiousness involved in this proceeding because of the varying interests of parties. So I tried to put myself in your shoes, and I decided that were I there, I would want to ask and answer the following basic questions, and I intend to have our remarks follow this outline. The first question is, why did the FCC create this joint board? In other words, what issues is the joint board addressing and why? The second question is, what process or procedures does the joint board use to fulfill its responsibilities? Third, what proposals are currently being considered by the joint board? And lastly, where does the joint board go from here? You earlier mentioned that Representative Hudson that you might have questions. I do hope that you or Representative Navarro or other representatives present would feel free to interrupt me as I go along, because I could well unintentionally resort to the vernacular and apologize in advance for that and would be pleased to offer any further explication. So why did the FCC create this joint board? What is it supposed to do? I've handed out to you quotes from the actual order, which states what the purposes are. And they are, one, to recommend, quote, any market structure changes necessary to harmonize rate integration and competition in the Alaska interstate market, close quote. And two, to recommend, quote, any changes in separations procedures relating specifically to Alaska that may be required to implement any market structure changes it recommends, close quote. What does that really mean? Seems to be a mouthful at best. I think to really understand what the Joint Board is attempting to do, it's necessary to go over some background in the development of the telecommunications industry, both nationally and Alaska. So what I'm going to begin with is what I will call sort of the Golden Book version of the history of telecommunications. And I've given you a timeline to sort of facilitate this discussion. In the beginning, there was the Bell system. They, of course, were around before the turn of the century. The Bell system was comprised of the local Bell companies, AT&T, the long-distance company, Western Electric, which manufactured equipment, Bell Labs, involving research and development, et cetera, et cetera. In the lower 48, essentially all telecommunication services were provided by the Bell system or a number of independent companies that were interconnected with the Bell system to form a comprehensive national network that operated by the same rules. What were those rules? Essentially, local companies were involved in providing both local service as well as toll service, state and interstate. The toll services were provided in conjunction with the long-distance companies who provided the transmission between the local companies, and the local companies provided access to the end users. The costs that the local companies experienced were divided between state, interstate, and federal jurisdictions in accordance with a cost separations manual that the FCC had adopted. Those costs, the in-state costs were in turn dependent on what the local commission decided as far as how those should be divided between state toll and local. In our case, the APUC essentially mirrors the FCC cost allocations manual. In any event, under this framework, All companies used AT&T essentially as a central bank, and they combined all the costs of providing toll service, and they shared the revenues that were received from those toll services. What you had is a situation where in some areas of the country costs were higher than rates, and in other areas they were lower, but in total, the toll rates were designed to cover the cost of the overall system. Now, this process of sharing costs, dividing revenues, was called settlements. And as long as the revenues that were collected were adequate to pay the overall cost of the system, it really didn't matter particularly how those particular rates related to costs in an area or to a particular class of customers. Additionally, in the lower 48, interstate toll rates were based on nationwide average rates. In other words, you paid the same amount for the same distance call, regardless of the cost. So those were the rules that were in effect until, lo and behold, the world began to change. Technological developments, the fact that there was increasing awareness of this disparity between what the rates were and the costs were in some markets. You had persistent market entrants who were eager to get involved in providing services. Governmental policies were evolving, etc. And then competition became the driving force in the world of telecommunications. As early as 1959, or maybe one could look at it as late as 1959, depending on one's perspective, the FCC first authorized essentially competition in the transmission area. They allowed companies to provide their own services. Now, in this day and age, that seems sort of hard to believe that one time people weren't able to provide their own services, but in fact, it just wasn't done. Subsequently, the FCC allowed carriers to provide private line services for others. The FCC, however, was still on a fairly conservative course. But in 1977, there was a court decision which had the effect of requiring the FCC to open the voice telecommunications market to competition, and MCI began actively competing with AT&T. I'm sure you're aware that customer premises equipment or telephones went through a similar evolution. At one point, we all got that stuff from our telephone company. Of course, now we are well aware and fully expect that we can shop around and find the equipment we want, where we want. I think it would be fair to say that before 1977, the prevailing philosophy at the FCC was that either the self-provision of telephone service or the few competitors providing private line service were in fact supplementing our basic telephone network. And they were still very much focused on what benefits or detriments the introduction of any competitive force would have to the monopoly provider. However, after 1977, the FCC clearly embraced pro-competition philosophy as its own, and subsequently competition rather than monopolies become essentially the policy norm. January 1, 1984, the Bell system was broken up through the modified final judgment. AT&T was required to divest itself of its local companies, and those local companies were required to begin to offer service to all inter-exchange or long-distance companies on a non-discriminatory basis. In other words, AT&T could no longer serve the central banking function. The settlements process, as it existed, was replaced by a system of access charges. The other initiative, besides introducing access charges, that the FCC undertook at this time was to consciously reduce the costs of service on the interstate side. And this was in response to the pressures of competition and an average rate system that they were observing. In the early 1980s, GCI was certificated to provide interstate service to Alaska. Turning to the Alaska history and trying to put that in sort of the national context. As I'm sure you're aware, the long distance network was originally started by the federal government and it was acquired by RCA Alaska and Alaska's predecessor in 1970. At the time, the network was extremely limited. There were well in excess of 140 communities that either had no long-distance service or only occasional ham radio service. So Alaskom's first initiative was to put rural radio service in communities in Alaska. That was subsequently replaced by the smaller station satellite system that we have in place today. Initially, there were just two lines, one for the public to use and one for public health services. Meantime, local companies were few and far between in Alaska. The medium and larger cities had local companies, but there were none operating in rural Alaska. Between 1979 and 1985, there was a flurry of certifications, and local companies began to operate in most of rural Alaska. And you saw then a more a structure that more closely resembled what you had outside. In 1977, a joint board was established, also typically called an Alaska Joint Board, the first Alaska Joint Board, I guess. And its purpose was to look to see how rate integration could be implemented for Alaska. Now, rate integration was the policy adopted by the FCC in 1972, which stated that with the advent of satellites, the benefits of nationwide average rates ought to be extended to Alaska, Hawaii, and other offshore points. Up to this point, however, Alaskom had interconnected with AT&T in the lower 48, and our interstate rates were really a lot closer to international rates than they were to interstate rates. In 1980, AT&T and Alaskom entered into the joint service arrangement. This was a partnership between AT&T and Alaskom, which provided that Alaskom would do the service from the lower 48 to and from Alaska, as well as within Alaska, and AT&T, of course, would provide service within the lower 48. AT&T would not be free to enter the market itself, Alaska market, that is. Nationwide cost separations rules were, at this point, adopted for Alaska, and after a transition period, nationwide average rates would be in effect in Alaska. In turn, AT&T would pay all of the costs of Alaska interstate service and receive all of the revenues, which by all accounts, we've certainly seen a number of different numbers in this proceeding, but in any event, I think there's at least the concession that they are considerably less than the costs. Also, at the inception of this transition, AT&T paid an additional amount to help pay for the high cost of Alaska service. This joint service arrangement was adopted by that first Alaska Joint Board and by the FCC, and it's what is currently in place and governs the provision of interstate service in Alaska. The effect is that AT&T continues to pay to Alaskom settlements, which are in many ways analogous to what the arrangement had had in effect with the Bell Independent Operating Companies until 1984. This joint board that's for you today was established, as you know, in 1985. In 1987, the final step of rate integration was accomplished. That additional supplement paid by AT&T to Alaskom was terminated. Subsequently, during the period 87 to 91, there was a massive restructuring of the intrastate telecommunications industry. The APUC, reacting to the policies and dictates, in some instances, of the FCC, went about the business of changing the uniform system of accounts, adopting a new cost separations manual, toll settlements for intrastate purposes were terminated, access charges were introduced, rules were established for competition. As you know, the law was passed in 1990, which supported the introduction of competition, and subsequently, GCI was certificated in 1991, and the following year, Sprint was certificated. Well, now, let's return, if we could, to these purposes that I gave you by road at the beginning of these comments to see if we can use this historical context to make some sense of it. I'd also like you to keep in mind, if you will, this chart that I handed out, which is a conceptual rendering of rates and costs. And what it's designed to do, again in a conceptual way, not in any sort of mathematically precise way, is to show that if you have rates that are set on an average basis. You're going to have some areas where costs are higher than rates and some that are lower. And in a situation where rate integration is the policy, rates, of course, are set on an average basis. Nonetheless, competition is a world that is governed and driven by costs. And so you can see that there are some conflicts that begin to emerge in a market. Competitors have different incentives to come into the market at point A than they do at point B. Point A, they have an opportunity to undercut the rates that the carrier offering average rates is selling its services at. At point B, they are inhibited from entering the market because they experience the higher costs and they don't have the benefit of the cost averaging that this carrier might have. Conversely, if you're the provider of those services at average rates, you're extremely sensitive to your total costs because you can see competitors nipping at your business in areas where you are charging rates that are higher than costs. This, in turn, raises issues with respect to what cost separations might be applicable to this particular market, because the cost line can go higher or lower depending on the cost separations process that one uses. So that, I guess, in a sort of a historical conceptual sense, is the issue that the Alaska Joint Board is trying to wrestle with. I'd like to turn next to the second question that I posed, which is what process or procedures does the Joint Board use to try to perform its responsibilities, to try to get its arms around these issues and examine whether or not there should be some changes in the market structure. The year after the Joint Board was created, it issued an order which requested extensive data on what it costs to provide both interstate and intrastate service. It also asked for a lot of demographic information about Alaska in order to better comprehend the magnitude of the high cost problem that Alaska was facing. I've already referenced the fact that in 1987 the Joint Board implemented the final step of rate integration. The next significant benchmark in the process was an order issued in January of 1989 by the Joint Board. In that order, it set forth certain tentative objectives or goals, and I've given you a handout with those printed on them. They are preserve universal service, continue rate integration, maintain jurisdictional revenue requirement neutrality, allow for market-based competitive entry, and increase efficiency. These goals or objectives have been the guiding light to the Joint Board as it has analyzed materials in front of it and attempted to move forward with any kind of resolution of the difficult issues at hand. That order also analyzed the comments and the materials that had been received in response to the early order and set forth two alternative plans for comment. Indeed, large number of comments and reply comments were filed, as well as alternative plans suggested, which in turn generated further comments among the parties. There was, however, after that order and the filings in response to that order, a hiatus in Joint Board activity. This was in large part because the intrastate market was undergoing such radical changes that members of the Joint Board did not feel it appropriate to move forward on interstate market changes before at least one half of the picture had resolved itself and settled in some manner. And about the time that it would have been appropriate and desirable to get the show on the road, Alascom and AT&T filed a master agreement. That was in February of 92. This was a proposal advanced by those parties to terminate the joint service arrangement that they had and establish a new interstate and intrastate market structure. Because it had interstate and intrastate implications, a parallel filing was made before the APUC. The master agreement dictated that final action be taken by the two regulatory bodies no later than November 1, 1992, although that date was subsequently extended to January 15, 1993. In In March of 92, the master agreement was put out for comment. Comments were received from a large number of parties. A lot of those from the state, including the state of Alaska, GCI, the Alaska Telephone Association, some individual local companies, all of whom uniformly criticized or opposed the master agreement. In addition to its own staff, the APUC had hired consultants to assist in the technical analysis of both matters pending before the state proceeding as well as the joint board proceeding, and briefing papers and testimony were filed in varying proceedings accordingly. In late July of 92, the state members of the joint board met with state staff and consultants to discuss the master agreement and the comments that had been received. As a result of those meetings, the state members issued a document which was entitled Memorandum of Understanding. It outlined some preliminary concerns we had with the master agreement and encouraged the parties to consider those concerns and possible revisions to the master agreement. Filings were forthcoming, and in October, the state members, staff, consultants had a special meeting in Chicago to review the master agreement, comments, responses to the Memorandum of Understanding, and based on those meetings, a Memorandum of Principles was developed, which set forth the state members' tentative findings and recommendations regarding the master agreement. The bottom line of that particular document was that the master agreement was not in the best interest of the public. However, I think it goes without saying that the master agreement provided stimulus to moving this process along. It clearly jump-started the joint board and got us going, as well as the parties who have been following this matter from its inception. In November of 92, there were ex parte presentations by the parties regarding the state members' memorandum of principles. That plan was ultimately put out for public comment by the FCC. In March, there were some extensive work sessions talking about the plan, the comments, etc. In late March, AT&T filed a consumer benefit plan, and then in May of this year, the tentative recommendation was issued by the joint board, which requested comments both on the tentative recommendation and consumer benefit plan. I guess to summarize, while the joint board proceeding has been under going on for a number of years, I think it would be fair to characterize the time since the filing of the master agreement as sort of the modern era of the joint board. And since that time, which is approximately 18 months, there's been an incredible record amassed addressing these issues. There have been 6 formal data requests that the state members of the joint board have issued to parties. There's been considerable amount of other data provided on a less formal basis. Recognized experts have evaluated the data and the issues, both on staff and private consultants. There's literally an enormous written record. I've given you in your packets 17 pages listing the filings that the commission has received since the beginning of 1992. In my own office, I have over 13 feet of bookshelves dedicated to this. I've discerned that I have read, in the last year and a half, a pile of materials 2.5 size my own times my own height in trying to stay abreast of the matters pending before this joint board. And mind you, this is an extracurricular activity for me. I still have my commission work that I'm doing. There have been scores of ex parte presentations by the parties under the rules that were established by the FCC at the inception of this proceeding. Parties can visit with the decision makers and staff. Subject to appropriate disclosure, and there have been hundreds of hours spent on conference calls and work sessions bringing us to where we are at this point in the process. It's really a formidable amount of material that we've been attempting to digest and comprehend over the last months. At this point, I'm sorry?
Have you prepared an executive summary?
Give me a few months and I can do it. At this point, you know, having sort of set the scene, I'd like to ask Lori to respond to the third question I posed, which is what proposals are currently being considered for resolving the issues? least with respect to the tentative recommendation, they represent the culmination of what's gone on over the previous months. So if I could. Hello, can you hear me?
My name is Lori Canyon, and I'm on the staff of the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, and I'm also assigned to Susan Knowles as a staff member before the Alaska Joint Forum. What I'd like to do is to summarize a tentative recommendation, the consumer benefit plan of AT&T, and then provide you a very brief overview of a summary of the comments that have been filed on both. Now, to help you along, there's been a chart, I believe it's at the back end of your packet, that provides you with a rough idea of the different mechanisms under the tentative recommendation of the Joint Board. The tentative recommendation was a multi-step plan to move Alaska to a new interstate market structure over the period of 10 years. A key part of that plan was to create a situation where Alascom and AT&T would operate independently of one another. To achieve this independence, the joint service arrangement, that is the agreement between AT&T and Alascom, was to be eliminated. For conceptual purposes, you might imagine the joint service arrangement as a partnership between the two utilities to provide long-distance interstate service to Alaska. The Joint Board's plan proposed a number of mechanisms to ensure that universal service at reasonable rates would continue and be preserved, given the partnership was dissolved. First, the plan required that AT&T continue to provide interstate long-distance services throughout Alaska to any customer that asked for that service. Furthermore, the service had to be provided at the same rates, terms, and conditions that AT&T provides service everywhere else in the nation. The goal for this requirement was to make sure that regardless of where you were in Alaska, you always had a carrier available, mainly AT&T, that would provide interstate service, and that you would be guaranteed of having the low rate integrated rate levels available to you. Alascom would continue to provide in-state services in the market. It would also be required to provide interstate private line services. The plan allowed Alascom to become an integral, to remain an interstate long-distance carrier in the market, but it would not be required to provide rates at rate integrated levels. The plan also required that the joint service arrangement settlement mechanism be replaced by a system of tariffs.
Explain what you said, that they would not be required to provide services at rate integrated levels. Can you expand on that a tiny bit for me?
Yes. AT&T has nationwide rates. It takes all of its cost, evaluates, and comes up with an average rate. Well, Alascom's costs aren't the same as AT&T's. Therefore, the plan stated that Alascom would not be required to set its rate at AT&T's levels.
Which assumes then perhaps that they would have higher rates, is that correct?
They could have higher rates, lower rates. There was no presumption, there was no statement in the order. Well, the order did not specify any presumption about what those rates would be. And Alascom itself had stated that it had did not have an intention to stay in the market if it was to compete against AT&T in that segment of the market.
If I could perhaps reaffirm something that Lori had said before, AT&T had the obligation to continue to provide interstate service to Alaskans at nationwide average rates. So there was that protection or assurance provided to Alaskans. The responsibility was no longer a function of this partnership. It was solely the responsibility of AT&T, which liberated Alaskan to stay in the market or not as it chose and charge what it chose.
To continue, the plan also required that the joint service arrangement, which is a settlement mechanism, be replaced by a system of tariffs. And the service, instead of being a joint service, it now was characterized as common carrier services by Alaska. The requirement was that the services would be provided under tariff so that a GCI or AT&T or any other interexchange carrier, if they needed Alaskom services, they know what the rates were, and they basically pay as they go. If they used a minute of service, they pay for the minute of service. Alaskom would not be allowed to leave the interstate market unless it had first petitioned the FCC to do so and followed their standard procedures that protected against abandonment of service. Alaskom would also be required to file a plan if it decided that it no longer wanted to continue in the interstate long-distance market. The plan would ensure that its current customers wouldn't be left stranded, that there would be a way that those customers would continue to have a smooth level of service. An important aspect of the tentative recommendation required that Alaskom reduce its interstate allocation factor for circuit equipment. The circuit equipment factor currently rests at 86%. The joint board proposal would reduce that factor to 75%. The order stated that the new factor would reduce a barrier to Alaskom's ability to compete efficiently in the market by reducing Alaskom's interstate costs. Also, the order stated that the 75% factor was more consistent with the character of Alaskom's costs. The joint board was concerned that this aspect of their proposal, as well as the other aspects of their proposal, would increase intrastate rates. Consequently, the joint board proposed a number of transition mechanisms to mitigate this problem. First, the joint service arrangement would be retained for 3 years. This would allow Alaskom to further adapt itself to the new market proposal and the new market structure. Second, the plan called for Alaskom's overall cost to be reduced through an accelerated cost recovery mechanism. AT&T and Alaskom were to file implementation plans to try to develop this exact accelerated cost recovery mechanism. One option suggested in the order was that a series of payments be made from AT&T to Alaskom to reduce the value of Alaskom's assets, or actually the book value on the records. Next, a requirement was placed on AT&T that it must purchase services from Alaskom for a series of 7 years. During the first 3 years, AT&T would be subject to the joint service arrangement, and it would have to purchase 100% of its services from Alaskom. After that, the series of common carrier service tariff would kick in, and for the last four of that 7 year transition period, AT&T would still have to purchase its services from Alaskom, but it would be under a gradually reducing level. For example, in the fourth year, it would go to 80% of the services that AT&T must purchase, and the fifth year would be 60%, so on until it reached zero. AT&T could buy more services, but they would not be required to. Lastly, the proposal suggested that the allocation factor that was to be reduced from 86% to 75%, that reduction would occur over a 10-year period. During the first 3 years, no change would occur. During the last 7 years, the allocation factor would change slowly over time. An Alaska Fund was created under the plan to allow Alaskom to set its rates immediately as if the 75% factor were in existence. The Alaska Fund paid for this to allow that to happen. Otherwise, Alaskom's rates would have to be set at the 86% factor. Secondly, the Alaska Fund paid for the phase-out from 86% to 75% on the state level so that the state could experience that phase-out and wouldn't be hit with this abrupt change. The Alaska Fund would be administered by a wholly owned subsidiary of the National Exchange Carriers Association. The fund would be paid for by interexchange carriers like AT&T and GCI and MCI in the market. Any carrier that contributed to the current universal service would also pay into the Alaska Fund. There are three other miscellaneous...
Representative Porter.
Thank you. Let me try to do what you just did on a previous point. I'm getting lost on this allocation factor. Could you kind of give us the basis for its existence in the first place, and then now what is it that you're doing?
When you make a phone call, a lot of different utilities provide service to make that phone call possible. And the same equipment is used regardless if you make an interstate call or an intrastate call. But there are different regulators that govern each piece. So when I place an intrastate phone call, the APUC governs how that works. When I place an interstate phone call, the FCC governs how that works. But since the same equipment is used for each, for the same call, it becomes very complicated as to who pays for what part of the equipment. So they developed at the FCC level a very elaborate separations manual that says, for example, for one piece of equipment, if that equipment carries 100 minutes of state calls and 200 minutes of interstate calls, then they're going to split it 1 to 2. And that's the type of factors that we're talking about. They have different factors for each type of equipment. The equipment that is specifically discussed here is called SERPET equipment. That's the satellite earth station equipment. It's the one of the more expensive parts of Alaska's system. Currently, that equipment is allocated based on a factor that considers mileage when it's being developed. And so the factor was set at a very high level, 86%, because when it was set, the mileage was based on measuring it from Seattle or the lower 40. commission is willing to pay for. Okay, so if you have a big piece of pie of all the dollars that is the cost of the circuit equipment, 86% of that cost pie would be paid for through interstate rates. Right. Now, that percentage has been frozen, I believe, since 1985 to current.
And it was originally based on?
On miles. It's a really, miles and minutes. It's a very complicated formula that says you basically add up all the minute miles in the system, and you have so many state minute miles and so many interstate minute miles. And that's how you divvy it up. And the miles were calculated based on point of interconnection in the lower 48, which meant you had more miles. You had all the miles going from, for example, Seattle to Anchorage added into the interstate pie. And the long and short of it is, at the end of that calculation, 86% of it became interstate costs, and 14% became state costs.
But to change that to 75 is arbitrary, not maybe that's not the right word, but it's not use-driven, it's some other goal. Is that fair?
The order specifically did not calculate a new minute-mile factor or a new minute factor. It stated it wanted a fixed factor, and it chose 75%.
Representative Boucher, did you have a question?
Yes. You mentioned telephone. Is that voice transmission, or does that include transmission of data, computer data, etc.?
Well, the joint service arrangement is primarily for the voice transmission. It's what we call switch services when you place phone calls. The private line, which is generally, that's generally what's used for data transmissions, is outside of the joint service arrangement. And AT&T and Alaska provide private lines separately from one another.
At this stage, maybe it's good even for myself to remind myself, since we haven't done this for a while, since we are on teleconference, we have Barrow and Homer and Kotzebue, and of course Washington, D.C. is listening in as well. So if you do have a question, state your name first so that we can make sure we get it on our recorder over there and the people on the line know who's talking. And I try my darndest to press the button and recognize you, but in case I miss it, give your name ahead of time and then ask your question. Better track of that. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Okay, I'll continue. The last point I'd like to make is that there's actually the last three points regarding the tentative recommendation that I'd like to make are as follows. First, AT&T doesn't serve predominantly in the interstate Alaska private line market. Generally, your choices are Alaska or GCI. The proposal said that if AT&T wanted to enter the interstate private line market in Alaska, it had to do it statewide, and it had to provide service the same as it does everywhere else in the nation, same terms, conditions. Second, United Utilities would use the same circuit equipment factor that Alaska would use, and this would occur because there are some parts of the Alaska network that United Utilities owns jointly with Alaska, generally for some of the earth stations. And as a last point, Alaska would be required to file its interstate tariffs and contracts with the FCC for approval. And that's a general summary of the tentative recommendation. There are some other points, but these are the high points.
The last point, this would be a deviation then from the norm. Alaskom would file with the FCC as opposed to the APUC for rates intrastate?
Not intrastate rates that I was referring to. This would be standard procedure that they would be recommending. Intrastates remain under the jurisdiction of the APUC, but the interstate special contracts, the interstate tariffs, would have to be filed with the FCC. And they do that today. Alaska files its interstate private line, and they have an interstate long-distance tariff with the FCC.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Navar?
Yeah, the requirement that AT&T provide to serve interstate service on a statewide basis,
mm-hmm.
Is that automatic, or are they allowed a transition time into that?
Well, technically, they do that today. It depends on how you view it. They do it today, but it's under the joint provisioning of the joint service arrangement.
back to the 86% versus 75%, does that mean that intrastate is going to pick up an additional 11% under any scenario?
Under this tentative recommendation, it would pick up that 11% at the end of the 10-year period.
Okay, and what will happen if it's not approved to the additional 11%? That I guess the argument is that that should be allocated in intrastate anyway.
Excuse me, could you repeat your question, please?
The 11% that we're talking about phasing out down to 75%, which intrastate will then be picking up. What happens if we don't go along with the joint board recommendation? What happens to that 11%? The allocation continued?
Presumably, if you don't change the factor, then it would still be picked up by AT&T in its, well, anybody who would pay for services from Alascom. Anybody who would buy Alascom services would pick up that 11% because the cost would go into the interstate tariffs or special contracts or whatever mechanism that is used for Alascom to sell its services.
And is that cost for the 11%, do you expect that, is the expectation that it will be recovered through cost efficiencies or simply interstate additional costs or combination?
The order stated there were a number of sources that they expected would take, would recover that 11%. I'm trying to find my notes to state exactly what they said. Well, let me try to do it from memory. Here we go. They stated that the 11% would be recovered through increased efficiencies, through cost cutting, through increased traffic demand, and through the various mechanisms, including the accelerated cost recovery mechanism that they had proposed.
Not that I probably want to read it, but what did they use to base those assumptions on?
It wasn't specifically spelled out in the proposal why those assumptions were made, except for that was their understanding of what would happen. I think that you can show, at least for the traffic stimulation factor, that they're, I'm using buzzwords, I'll explain what it means, but when they're stating that they're assuming that some increase in demand will occur, what they're telling you is that over time people make more and more phone calls. And we have historical records that say that this is the case not only in Alaska, but throughout the nation. The statistics I've seen recently show that for the last 2 or 3 years, the intrastate call volume has gone up from around between 8 and 11%, depending upon what year you're looking at. So I would presume that they were basing their analysis on the data that they had before them and on their experience.
Representative Brown, did you have a question on this one?
With respect to the joint board's recommendation, what level of detail did you have from the companies with respect to their costs and their revenues to be able to determine that this would, well, let me ask, are you assuming that there will not be an increase in costs to users in Alaska if this tentative recommendation were implemented? And did you have the underlying hard data from the companies to be able to reach that conclusion?
The order specifically asked parties to comment on what they thought the interstate cost shift would be as a result of this plan. We've received a variety of data from Alascom regarding what they believe or what it believes would be the cost shift depending upon whether or not the tentative recommendation was put into effect. We also have extensive separation studies for Alascom. We have an incredible amount of volume of data on Alascom's costs, both before the APUC through various proceedings that have occurred at that level and through the six data requests that the joint board state members had placed in the requested from the companies.
With respect to the changes that are occurring generally in the computer industry, which affects the cost of telecommunications, are those declining costs continued to be factored in out to the year 2004? That's one question. The second question is, to what extent are you assuming that universal service remains the same, or are you assuming that a new level of universal service is provided given the changes occurring in all these industries?
To answer your first question, we are currently evaluating the forecasted information that is provided given the various assumptions regarding market growth, cost declining curves, and things of that nature, planned investment, and I'm not prepared to give you a response regarding our results yet at this time. Regarding the universal service question, the order does not specifically state if it assumed there would be growth or whatever with universal service, but it appears to be one of the goals of the joint board that universal service would be promoted. So therefore, I'm assuming that if the plan that they presented would not degrade universal service, at least in their eyes.
Well, universal service, I guess, as it's been defined, means everybody has access to a telephone, and now there's a growing demand for high-speed data transmission and public uses in schools and health clinics and all kinds of other things. So, for example, we heard recently from the Bethel Consortium that they don't think 1,200 baud is adequate to meet their needs and requirements. Is universal service locked at this particular point in time, or do we get better service in the future under this arrangement?
I think I can respond in part. The Alaska Joint Board has not undertaken what is an exercise that's being done nationally, and that is to attempt to define universal service. Your question is an insightful one, but it's also one that is sort of intractable right now because it's one that's being debated nationally. I personally participated in a couple of think tank sessions where we as regulators are very much trying to get our arms around that, particularly as the industry is converging and merging and changing so dramatically. There was no conscious attempt made to be the first out of the box to come up with the new definition of universal service. On the other hand, I think we are extremely conscious of the fact that we need to position the Alaska market so that it is receptive as a matter of basic structure to the changes that occur everywhere else. At least at that level, we're very sensitized to it, but you're not going to see, I don't think, in any final work product, the new national definition of universal service coming forward from this joint board.
Going back to the question about the cost of computers, did I understand your answer to be that you're assuming computer costs continue as they are today? I didn't understand what you said in answer to that.
The answer I gave you was that we're looking at it right now, and our people, I'm not prepared to tell you all the assumptions we are going to make or have made regarding our analysis of the costs that are given to us and the ones that we eventually may develop as a result of our analysis.
But some assumptions were made, right, in coming up with the tentative recommendation about what these costs would be in the future?
We're dealing with a declining cost industry generally. We're also dealing with an industry that is modifying its cost structure as a result of competitive forces, and all of this has been certainly factored in. We also had the benefit of information provided in the context of the master agreement, which addressed the issue of efficiencies and modifications and operations that could be possible. So it has been, certainly factored in one sense. We are continuing to evaluate this. This is a tentative recommendation for precisely that reason. We want as much information as we can before it becomes the final recommendation.
Susan, this is probably one of the areas that was most troubling to me as I went through this entire regimen of background materials. We don't, it's not twice my height, thank God for that, because I probably wouldn't understand it anymore if it were. But one of the concerns that I've had is that there's been very little hearings in Alaska. I don't think there's been a whole lot of communications, even with policymakers or decision makers, to try to identify what are the long-term needs for Alaska, not necessarily just the citizens of Alaska, but for services that are going to be provided over time. You know, we're sitting down in Juneau, Representative Brown and my colleagues and I, discussing and actively considering expanding interactive video teleconferencing. We have agencies that are really eager to get in there and try to use this state of the art, and in many respects it appears to me at any rate as though that's going to expand the use along those lines for that purpose. On the other hand, from a policy point of view, we are very likely looking at a rapidly declining economic base, revenue base, to provide a lot of these services. And so what I'm interested in is that, do you have any analysis or studies that professionally, that you've acquired professionally, that analyzes the long-term needs of the people of the state of Alaska that have been used in making your determination to come up with this recommendation to, you know, to drop it to 75 and then to phase it out over the next 4 years? And do your studies or your analyses, which I would hope that you provide us a copy with, at least for the record. This committee wants to become at least a repository of the high-grade information that makes the decisions that are going to affect the lives of the consumers of the state of Alaska, the people of Alaska. So I guess the first question is, do you have such studies or analysis that gives you this understanding of what's going to be needed out there over, say, over 10 or 15 years?
I think the answer is yes, but we are continuing to acquire more knowledge and more information as we move forward in this process. There isn't any one piece of paper or one study that says it all. It's the cumulative effect, beginning back in 1986, when the state of Alaska, for example, provided extremely useful fundamental demographic data about the state of Alaska, where people are, what the economy is like, what the terrain is like, I mean, just basic information that advanced the decision makers' understanding of what they were dealing with. And it's been the cumulative effect of many, many studies and a lot of data. In addition, the individuals who comprise the joint board are charged in their capacities as state regulators or federal regulators with representing the public interest. They wrestle with telecommunications issues, the sort you all are wrestling with as well, as a daily diet. That's what we do for a living. And we are constantly concerned with, you know, what the public needs, what the public is well served by. And so all of that experience and our awareness of what's happening elsewhere, that's one, I think, advantage of having a individuals outside of Alaska who are part of the joint board process, is brought to bear on the thinking as we deal with these very difficult Alaska-specific issues. And they also deal with them with some recognition that, you know, this some of the tensions that are there in the market structure are not necessarily unique to Alaska. Happen to be in the forefront right now because we have this problem in front of us, but they have broader implications as well. So,
but Susan, come back to my concern about the representation of the interest of the people of Alaska as stated by the people of Alaska. I looked through the list of, as you just provided us here, of all of the correspondence and everything else, and I don't really see it. Maybe you have it, and I'd like to have it if you have it, some appreciable input from Alaskans. You know, the only reason that we're constituted is to try to protect the consumers of the state of Alaska, and what I fear often in a joint board that, what is it, four members, three of which are non-Alaskans, mm-hmm. and, you know, I mean, we have a right to be a little bit suspect of what their motives and understanding of Alaska's needs are. And I know you do, and I have a great respect for you, and I know you've been there for some time. But as it was one policymaker, at any rate, I'd really like to see some justification. What I'm trying to get to is that what kind of assurances do we have that the proposals for service from the various entities are based on, you know, some rational judgment, and have they been bounced off of the people who, you know, have to use the services, particularly in rural Alaska? I guess that's my biggest concern. It probably was the biggest reason that I convened this hearing, was because I was concerned that rural Alaska, and that carrier of, a carrier that we could hold responsible and regulate, you know, would be here 10 years from now, the satellite would be replaced, that you could guarantee that it'd be replaced, that rates would be controlled, and that services would be those that were needed and demanded by the people of Alaska, as well as the state of Alaska. And so if you have some specific studies, I know that the legislature, as I look back into the thing, did underwrite and pay for one of the studies here. Let's see. I believe that the state of Alaska underwrote part of Overland Consultants' service with the analysis of interstate matters. Is that correct?
Well, the state of Alaska underwrites me, Lori, and any consultants that we hire through our APUC.
But did you
yes.
Hire Overland Consultants?
Yes.
And so you have a report or analysis from Overland?
We have a report that they had presented when the master agreement was in front of us, and they are continuing to develop what are now proprietary staff work papers evaluating the data that's been received in the comments, but which will become public in due course. I guess that's the best I can say.
Ms. Boucher.
That's a question, Susan. In due course. Now, you have, excuse me, Red Boucher. I think the feeling that I have, studies, we're the only state that has a telecommunication conference that the governor is on. We, by law, do not allow anybody lower than the commission to serve on it. So I think there's a general impression out there, Mr. Chairman, if I may, and I'll just editorialize slightly, that we are ignorant of telecommunications issues in the state of Alaska. I think that is far from true. I mean, I think some of maybe the people in private industry don't realize the in-depth study that's gone as it relates to rural Alaska. But the question now, to me, you have Overland Consultants, does not Mr. Katz back in Washington, D.C., is there not also some consultants there? And is this information available to APUC or the policy makers of the state of Alaska?
Well,
thank you, Ms. Chairman.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I believe the analysis and the studies that have been performed by private and public entities have been reflected in the comments that have been filed, et cetera. Now, the state will be on next. They can speak for themselves as to how they have used their resources, but I believe the numbers that have been advanced in the studies and the state's comments reflect the results of those, that input.
I thought you were going on, Susan.
Well,
you thought maybe I better stop now while I'm here.
No, I wasn't sure if I was starting to meander.
Yeah, so I guess the studies that were part of which, the Overland study, which was part of the joint submittal some time ago between AT&T and Alaskan.
Yes.
That is public information, and anybody who wants
that's
it can
right.
have it. Now, new studies that are taking place now
are still in progress.
And they're not public yet until they're finished.
Until they're finished, in part because the Alaskan data, which we recently requested, precisely when the data request was, I guess in April, was received in July. It was delivered to me in my hotel room in San Francisco. And so we've not had very long to look at it, but we are actively looking at it. And that
analysis will be available to the parties for their purview prior to any decisions made by the joint board?
I can't tell you exactly what the process will be in that regard. I think the typical sort of regulatory approach is that when you have staff who are advisors to a commission, the parties present their studies, the staff assists you in analyzing the studies, and unless you create a new work product as opposed to an analytical critique of other parties' work products, that, you know, analytical critique becomes part of the decision-making process as opposed to something that's subject to another round of comments. So there's a sort of two different routes that could be undertaken here.
So an analytical critique would be something that would be an internal document that would be used?
It would be reflected in the decision. Don't misunderstand that, but I mean, ultimately, you as decision makers close the record. You use your own brains and your own staff and your own analytical tools to evaluate that record, and you come up with a decision which you support based on your independent analysis of the record. We go through a similar process. If we always then put that out for comment, we would in effect never conclude the process, because then that comment would generate new things. We would then do our independent thinking. We would produce yet another, potentially yet another work product, which, do you see the distinction? Now that is, I think, should be contrasted with a situation where you have someone generate an original work product that you in fact put out for public scrutiny and that you want people to evaluate, critique, and give you feedback on. We're in the mode right now, I'd say, of the former, which is the parties have had many opportunities to give us data. We are evaluating that data using our own brain power, horsepower, if you will, to see what makes sense.
Representative Barr.
So if someone were to critique what happened at the joint board, would we have to derive the information that you have reached, or the conclusion you've reached, from the same information that the parties give to you without the benefit of having seen what your independent internal critiques of that material was that led you to whatever conclusion the joint board comes up to? How do we know, as policymakers for the state, that you interpreted the material correctly?
Well, you may never know that. That will be, believe me, in the eye of the beholder, and you can expect conflicting reviews. But the more typical approach, and I reflect my APUC experience, is when you issue an order that involves commission evaluation of data, you have appendices that are attached to the order that detail, you know, the kind of economic analysis or financial analysis that led you to conclude what you concluded. So it's not like it's a mystery.
And do you continually work with whoever submits that information to you to try to make sure that there haven't been any misstatements or, so that you get a continual update on something that's in there so that you don't misconstrue what was attempting to be said?
We do the best we can, recognizing that we have advocates who are appearing before the joint board. They are attempting to present information in the best light for their own interests, but just to use this most recent iteration of data as an example, in its comments, Alaskan provided certain information in a rather summary form and made certain representations. We issued a data request asking them to please give us the underlying studies that you used to put those numbers in your filing. They provided that to us. Since then, there have been informal discussions, follow-up discussions to require additional information or better understanding that information.
I apologize. That last question was a stupid question. Of course you do. I just didn't think before I proposed your question. Back to the 11% cost allocation. You mentioned that you looked at efficiencies that are going to be achieved through cost efficiencies, increase in usage, and something else, and you mentioned that 8 to 11% is the historical increase or something like that in usage. Have we seen a cost reduction over that historical period of time from the same factors that you're using to project that we'll see it in the future, the 11% recovery?
Perhaps I should explain that we had received a large amount of voluminous financial data in July from Alaska, and much of this data is fairly new. That's the point that I can't explain further how our analysis is going, but we are looking at that in great detail and taking into account the things that you've just discussed to see how it all fits together and what the end result is.
But Alaska has had some significant intrastate rate decreases, Representative Navarre, during this, in the recent past, at the same time intrastate traffic, was increasing. I don't know if that, directly
that helps,
responds
that's what
to...
I'm trying to find out is if we've seen increases.
Both before, and maybe I should qualify my remarks to say in anticipation of a change in market structure, and after the market structure changed, i.e. the introduction of competition, there were some significant intrastate rate decreases.
Decreases.
My apologies. Mumbled.
Thank you.
Susan, one more time then. will there
I'll
be,
pick up.
When you, what I understand now is what you have is a sort of a tentative recommendation. This is not the final, is that correct? You tell me that you're still analyzing data
That is absolutely correct.
Now, will there be a hearing in Alaska when you come up with some final product that the people of the state of Alaska can have some input into?
I would say no hearing is currently contemplated. Hearing, albeit somewhat, perhaps much maligned, that was held on July 1st, was scheduled to at least raise consciousness and provide an opportunity for comment. I don't know if those who participated were aware that essentially such a hearing is unprecedented on the part of the FCC. Unlike the State Regulatory Commission, they don't do public hearings. That's just not their normal operating mode. We found, Lori in particular, in working out the logistics with them, that they didn't really have a clue about a public hearing. And nonetheless, I was very pleased, and this was in large part because of the prompting of Senator Stevens, that they were willing to embark on this experiment from their perspective. And I do think it did provide an opportunity for some members of the public to become better aware and talk or comment. I think, given what I've said, you might discern that it would be somewhat outside the realm of their normal practices to contemplate a further public hearing in Alaska. Is it possible? Anything is possible.
And I have one additional question, and we're doing fine here. One of the things that appears to be extremely important in these matters is the way in which the industry is regulated is on the basis of whether or not they're designated dominant carrier. And in reading the proposal and looking over the material here, if it were to turn out that it all went forward and the joint proposals recommendations happened and the subsidy was phased out and and competition occurred and development by AT&T as an example, putting new infrastructure, et cetera, occurred. Looking now at the rural side of our needs here, the intrastate side of it, assuming that the market will not hold or carry three principal providers, Alascom, AT&T, GCI, perhaps even more. Alascom at the present time is the dominant carrier and therefore the pervasively regulated carrier for the intrastate side. You can tell them, I believe, and that's what I want you to tell me here, you can be assured and you can make sure that the public is protected that when the satellite by the year 2001 or two or whenever, you know, falls out of grace with the rest of us here, is replaced. And that, now we're talking about $100 million, as I understand it, from what I've been able to read. If Alascom exits the scene, do you have assurances that AT&T will assume the dominant carrier position? That is, will they become responsible under FCC requirements to not only the rates, but also the upgrading, expansion of technology, and including the one thing that worries me most, I guess, is that who's going to put that next satellite up there and have it, you know, really reflect down on all parts of rural Alaska, including the Aleutians and things of this nature. It's my understanding that other satellites see part of Alaska, but not all of Alaska. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
Can you give me some response to this concern I have?
Where to begin? I'm trying to separate the intrastate side from the interstate side because your question involved both in a sense, because under the tentative recommendation, AT&T would be essentially the carrier ultimately responsible for delivering rate-integrated interstate service to Alaska, and it in that
inter between Alaska and
that's
other
right.
states.
And it in that capacity would need to be able to have a satellite that performed, you know, the necessary connectiveness responsibilities that a satellite does. Similarly, Alascom, with its intrastate responsibilities, would also be very concerned with that. I do know that Alascom, in at least one of its pleadings, has suggested that under the tentative recommendation, its response would be to examine what the most cost-effective alternatives would be for providing satellite service, i.e., should it consider launching yet another Aurora satellite, or should it consider getting transponder capacity on one or more satellites to meet its service obligations. I think the expectation at a minimum is that there would be detailed and a conscientious examination of what the least cost alternative was for providing the service. Neither carrier, as long as it has its service obligations, can